Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest today is Michael Snyder, who is the principal behind the blog called The Economic Collapse. He's also the author of a new book that I don't have. I don't have it sitting right here in front of me. We'll get to it shortly. He has a degree in commerce from University of, trying to scroll through, Bachelor's of Science in Commerce, University of Virginia. He's a Juris Doctor, meaning an attorney from the University of Florida. And he has a Master of Laws in Taxation from the University of Florida. So we have a very educated man who is he'll be joining us shortly, and this should be a very interesting program. Before we get to Michael, let's do the market report. We've got gold is up $7.70 today to $1,343.90, and isn't that a relief? You know, it wasn't too long ago we were down at $1,200 an ounce, maybe even a little under that, and people were got us all talking to ourselves, and it has finally rebounded. And it does look as if we've seen the bottom, and we are now once again going back into a full-fledged bull market. Now, it's too early to say that's true for sure, but it appears possible, probable, and we'll watch to see what happens in the future. Silver is down 7 cents to $20.58 an ounce. Platinum is up a buck to $1,453 per ounce. Palladium is down six to $743 an ounce. Dow Jones up 23 points to 15,569. NASDAQ is down 21 to 3,579. New York Stock Exchange is up 12 points, 9,662. U.S. dollar index is off 0.24, 81.98. It's down below the 82 mark, which is a little bit significant. It doesn't prove a great deal, but we've seen the U.S. dollar index just in the last couple of weeks up as high as in the 84 range, and now it's down to the 81 range, just below 82. It's interesting. We'll see what happens in the future. Crude oil is up 33 cents a barrel to $107.27 per barrel. Operating on the assumption that our guest is present, I'm going to say, hi, Michael, how are you?
I'm doing great, and it's a real pleasure to be on with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. You know, I've looked at your blog, The Economic Collapse, on a fairly regular basis over the past, I'm not sure, perhaps a year, 6 months or a year. I didn't know you were the author per se, but I regard it as a reliable resource, and I was much surprised to see your education level. Melody sent me an email after she scheduled you as a guest. You're familiar, you know your way around the universities, apparently.
Yeah, I've spent far too much time at some of our public universities. But, you know, the truth is that, you know, those pieces of paper don't mean a whole lot. I've learned far more on my own than I ever did at those institutions of so-called higher learning. So, and, you know, when you go to those universities, you get the information and the outlook and the values of that those institutions are pushing. You kind of get programmed in a way.
That's exactly
right. And that's one of the, and that's one of the big problems of today is that, you know, people are not thinking of themselves. They're just caught in the paradigm that the mainstream media and that the education system is pushing. And people need to kind of break out of that, do their own research, come to their own conclusions, and really start to think for themselves.
What do you think is the most important knowledge that you may have gained while you were in the universities? And now I have an answer for that, and I'd be surprised if you had the same answer. It's just an interesting question to me. What do you suppose was the most important lessons, if any, that you learned at the university?
Yeah, well, one thing that I kind of came to the conclusion as I went through all those years, all those levels of education, from when I was a very small child, I thought, well, you know, my teachers here at the elementary school don't really seem to understand what's going on. But when I get to the next level, then they'll really have all the answers for me. And I kept going up and up and up, expecting that, okay, you know, I'm going to get to the level where people actually understand what's going on, can explain, you know, where people have really got it all together and can kind of explain the system and everything and all the truths of the world. And they really have it all together. But, you know, I got to the top level, I realized they don't have the answers. You know, they really don't know what's going on. So just realizing that is kind of horrifying, but it's also kind of liberating at the same time.
My answer to the question, what's the most important lesson, if there is one, is learning how to educate yourself. Self-education, for me, is the key, and it parallels some of the remarks you made that the degree becomes a piece of paper over time. Knowledge is advancing at such an extraordinary rate. You know, the only way anyone can keep up is through self-education, even in something like law. You might think a lot of people would think that law wouldn't be advancing at breakneck speed. Science might be, even economics might be, but you'd kind of think maybe law is a little more stable, but no, that's moving. So the key to all of this is people must learn to think for themselves, as you said, and to educate themselves, and if they can do that, and it's hard to do.
It takes an unusual individual. It takes work, and you have to get up from sitting in front of the, you know, reality television shows and actually do reading and dig in and do research and look into things for yourselves and not just take the prepackaged information you get from the news or the mainstream media. And so it does take work. It does take effort. But it's so imperative in these days and times for people to educate themselves and to do their own research and to come to their own conclusions.
And what do you suppose it tells us about a society where people, even at the top, don't understand what's going on?
Well, it's frightening, and partly it's a symptom of our, you know, I call it our dumbed-down population. Our system of education is producing people that can't think critically, that can't, unfortunately, you know, and as you also mentioned, the pace of change today is unlike anything we've ever seen before. Things are changing at lightning speed. And then you realize, you look at, you know, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke or Barack Obama or our politicians or people running various institutions and just realizing, hey, they don't have the answers. They don't know how to fix things. They're just, you know, and it's kind of frightening because, you know, as I believe, we're rapidly heading toward the kind of the culmination of decades of very, very bad decisions in this country. And the people in charge are not prepared to deal with the challenges that are coming.
I don't think they know how. I've made the same observation over the years. It's like we're running downhill in a car that doesn't have any brakes, running down the mountainside with a driver who doesn't even know how to drive. Now, he expresses great confidence that we can trust him, and everyone is riding along. Oh, trust Obama or trust Bernanke. We can trust them. But in the final analysis, they don't even know what they're doing, as near as I'm able to see. I agree with you, but I wonder at times, are they truly ignorant, or do you subscribe to any conspiracy theories that allege that behind the ignorance, it's used as a veil to conceal nefarious motives? Are they doing it to us by accident or by intent?
That's a very good question. You know, to a certain extent, I think it's not necessarily 100% one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, I think that the people perhaps with the more nefarious motives are those that are wielding power behind the scenes. You know, I don't know if Barack Obama or Ben Bernanke are smart enough necessarily to come up with some great evil plots, but it's just frightening to see what's happening to us, what's happening to our society, what's happening to our economy, you know, with these people who, you know, you just go back to, you know, right before the 2008 crisis and the things Bernanke was saying, you saying, oh, we're definitely not going to have a recession. Mm-hmm. Oh, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are definitely not going to fail. You know, and I've listed out dozens of quotes in the past on my website, which shows how Bernanke was completely clueless about what was about to happen in 2008. And yet what happened? Barack Obama renominated him to a second term, and it's just been 100% supportive of him when he has a track record of miserable failure.
I'm not even sure how much of a track record he's got. He's got a track record for maybe the last 6 or 8 years, but beyond that, he wasn't in the White House, of course, all of that time, but beyond that, even his track record is a little bit foggy. We're not sure who he is or where he came from. The whole world has become bizarre. Let's take a look at an article that you've published on your blog just recently, and it says it's entitled "Share This Chart with Anyone Who Believes the U.S. Economy Is Not Going to Crash." And you start out saying anyone who thinks the U.S. economy can keep going along like this is absolutely crazy. You point out we've had an unprecedented debt spiral that allowed us to live far beyond our means. And one of your charts illustrates that the debt, the national debt, and the gross domestic product were marching along pretty much in lockstep from after World War II up until about 1970, when the debt began to grow dramatically as compared to the gross domestic product, and you see this divergence. The debt is much greater. It has grown, but looking at the chart, it's increased by 300% more than the gross domestic product. That's just an eyeball guesstimate, but you can correct me on that. What is the significance of the debt outgrowing the gross domestic product?
Well, our debt has grown at a far, far faster rate than our overall economy is. And so I believe that we're at the terminal phase of the biggest debt spiral the world has ever seen. You go back 40 years ago, and the total amount of debt in our system, government debt plus corporate debt plus consumer debt, all forms of debt, 40 years ago, it was about $2 trillion. Today, it is more than $56 trillion. So it's gotten more than 28 times larger, the total amount of debt. Meanwhile, our economy has grown, but nowhere near that level. So, and in fact, economic growth now is barely registering in the positive, and that's if you believe the official government numbers, which, you know, others such as John Williams from ShadowStats.com and others have shown those might not necessarily be accurate either. But even if you accept the official government numbers, economic growth is essentially almost flatlining now, and yet our debt continues to explode. And it's been on all, not just the national debt, which back in 1980 was a little over, you know, about $1 trillion, now is nearly $17 trillion, but all forms of debt in this country have absolutely exploded. And there's only so much debt. All debt spirals eventually end, and usually in a very disorderly manner. And there's only so much debt that you can, you know, accumulate and pump a system full with until you get system failure. We've seen it happen in Greece and Portugal and Italy and Ireland and Spain. You know, we just saw it happen in Detroit. And so, you know, the United States as a whole is rapidly approaching this point as well. And in fact, we already have, of all those nations I just mentioned, Greece, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, and Spain, the United States already has more debt per capita and more government debt per capita than all those nations, you know, which are basket cases themselves.
I understand.
So we're...
You mentioned that every debt spiral the world's ever seen, if I understood you correctly, has ended badly. And I'm curious how many of those debt spirals were based on fiat currency and how many of them were based on a currency that was gold or silver based, that was backed by physical metal.
Well, and that's kind of the unique, what makes our situation unique is that we have, you know, in the past, you know, throughout history, most of the currencies of the world have been based on gold, silver, you know, solid money.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're, you know, since 1971, we've been on the fiat currency spiral. And that's, you know, kind of at the point where we saw the total amount of debt in our society start to really diverge from the growth of our economy. And so we're really in unprecedented territory. At this point, no one knows quite what is going to happen next. And people talk, well, is it going to be a deflationary depression when it bursts? You know, or is it going to be a hyperinflationary depression where they just print money like crazy in order to try to, you know, keep things afloat? So, you know, people debate about, you know, what trajectory things are going to take. You know,
nobody
without
knows.
A doubt. Yeah, nobody knows. And so much of it depends on how the government, the Federal Reserve, and the authorities respond to the matter. But we're definitely heading for very, very difficult times.
And you illustrate the fact that there's even debate. There's a certain amount of agreement, not with everyone, but with a lot of people, that this is going to end badly. But how will it end? Just as you say, we could go into significant deflation, or we could go into hyperinflation. Where are we going to go? Insofar as that's a legitimate debate, will it be hyperinflation? Will it be inflation? Which one are we going to? It's evidence that no one really knows what's going on. And again, that all by itself, that has to be frightening. No one is in control.
Oh, it's true. And there is, you know, debate. People say, is it going to be inflation? Is it going to be deflation? And personally, I believe that we're going to see some of both.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I believe that when we hit the next major financial crash, the next major stock market crash, I believe that we are going to have a period of deflation. And it might be a relatively short period, but right now, most of the forces in our economy and our financial system, I believe, are pushing us toward deflation. It's just the Federal Reserve with all the crazy money printing and the wild government spending have tried to prop things up and have kind of provided an inflationary counterbalance. But I believe when we see the next stock market shock, and, you know, and kind of like in 2008, credit froze up. You know, banks aren't lending money. Everyone's afraid to lend to one another. That's going to cause deflation already. The velocity of money is at a 50-year low right now. We've got the trade deficit, which is constantly sucking money out of the system. You know, already we're seeing wages and salaries as a percentage of GDP at near a record low. And so all those things are deflationary forces in our economy. And I believe that's going to prevail for a time, but then eventually I believe the response is going to come in and we're going to see the Federal Reserve and the federal government come in just with such a wave of printing and spending like we've never seen before, and that'll
swing
deflation.
We'll talk about that. We're going to break, Michael, we're going to break for a couple commercial announcements, and we will discuss whether we're going to inflation or deflation, which is more likely, and when we might see it when we return to financial survival. I'm Alfred Addis, here with Michael Snyder. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Adisk. I'm here on Financial Survival with our guest, Michael T. Snyder. Michael is the author of The Beginning of the End, a novel that discusses what is likely to happen in the foreseeable future with our economy, and it includes a lot of economic insight. It's good entertainment, but it's also educational, and it may be a good idea. It's the kind of book that might be helpful to introduce maybe your children, maybe your parents, maybe your spouse to a little insight into economics without having to actually crack open a book by Samuelson on economics. We may be able to learn something. And Melody, her special for today will be a free copy of Michael's book, The Beginning of the End, with every order of any gold products. If you're ordering any gold coins from Melody today at Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. You'll get a free copy of Michael's book, The Beginning of the End. We'll talk more about Michael's book in a couple of moments, but first let's get back to when we closed for commercial break. We were considering whether we were more likely to see inflation in the first and then deflation, or and Michael, I believe you believe you think we'll see deflation first and later inflation. Is that true?
Yeah, now the period of deflation might be quite short, depending on the timing of the response by the Federal Reserve and by the federal government and so forth. But I believe that that we will see that period first. I believe a stock market crash is coming. I believe that a financial panic is going to grip Wall Street. I believe derivatives are going to be at the center of it. And I believe that is going to cause fear and panic just to sweep throughout the financial world. And so if you thought getting a loan or getting credit back in 2008 during the height of the crisis was bad, I believe it's going to be even worse this next time, this next wave. And so that'll cause lending to freeze up. And in our society, our system is based on credit. Without the flow of credit, nothing goes. You know, people can't order new product. People can't pay their workers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, because the flow of credit is everything. And so when credit freezes up, economic activity is going to kind of grind to a halt. Unemployment is going to skyrocket. The velocity of money is going to go down even farther, even though it's at a 50-year low right now. And we're just going to see this deflationary shock to the system. Now, it might only last even a few months, a year, or it, you know, it just depends on the response. But I believe the response to that will be the greatest wave of money printing, government spending, and inflationary kind of reaction that we've ever seen in U.S. history. And at that point, I believe we'll see gold, silver, precious metals, commodities go skyrocketing like we've never seen before. And so, you know, for people who want to invest in gold and silver, I tell them, hey, you know, be patient. You know, it's going to be a wild ride, but if you hang in there for the end, for the long term, you're going to be very, very happy.
Now, I am inclined to think that the first thing we will see is the inflation. And I'm inclined to think that it'll be followed by deflation and a depression. That's my opinion on it. And my crystal ball is no better than anyone else's, maybe yes, maybe no. But can you explain to people why you believe the deflation is going to tie up our access to credit? Why would credit dry up in a period of deflation?
Right, right. Well, I believe that the credit drying up will cause the deflation, because in order to have an inflationary environment, you need money to be moving. You need people to be spending money, you know, businesses that, you know, the money to be flowing through the economy. If money doesn't flow through the economy, then suddenly it seems like nobody has any. And so what could cause this? I believe that, you know, what is likely to cause this to happen is rising interest rates. And right now we've started to see that over the last couple months, we started to see interest rates, the yield on 10-year U.S. Treasuries do things that we haven't seen in a very, very long time. And so we've seen just over the last couple months, the yield on U.S. Treasuries nearly, double. You know, from where it was sitting at a record low. But the thing is, we have so much more room to go up. You know, we've seen this 30-year bull market for 10-year U.S. Treasuries. But now that it's shifting, it's going to have such an effect in our economy. For one thing, it's causing mortgage rates to go up. Mortgage rates go up, it becomes much more expensive to buy a house. It becomes more difficult to sell a house. It has a horrible effect on the real estate market. We're just starting to see the leading edge of this.
And well, when
it becomes more expensive. Oh,
okay, go ahead. When we see deflation, the dollar becomes more valuable, and it purchases more. And that's good for creditors, and it's bad for borrowers. We've been all taught throughout my lifetime to borrow money to get a mortgage. Because of inflation, we'll be able to pay off that mortgage with cheaper dollars. We might borrow, it might be a dollar might be worth 100 cents today, but 20 years from now, that same dollar might only be worth 20 cents. And we would be, therefore, if we had to pay off $1,000 a month, it would be equivalent to $200 a month in today's dollars. Inflation encourages us to borrow. It discourages lenders from lending. Deflation, on the other hand, is good for the lenders if they can collect. The problem is, in a period of deflation, who has any money to repay their bills? And it's all very confusing, and it's almost like something from Alice and the Red Queen. But it's because we're dealing with a fiat currency. We can't deal reasonably and rationally. We can ride a wave, but we can't seem to just deal reasonably and rationally, or can we? Is there a reason here that we can understand anywhere down the line, even if the people up at the top don't understand what's happening, what is it that we can understand that may do us some good?
Well, when fear becomes the overriding factor, kind of, you know, people don't think rationally, and financial institutions don't think rationally. And so when we see a financial panic, when we see a bubble burst, and I believe right now we've seen just a little bit of a mini housing bubble, when we see housing prices start to fall rapidly again, banks don't want to lend money on a home that's rapidly losing value. They don't want to they don't want to do mortgages because they're like, well, I'm going to give you a mortgage today, and then, you know, 6 months from now, your house is going to be, you know, $30,000, you know, drop $30,000 in value. You're going to be underwater, and then, you know, maybe in a couple of years you walk away from the home, and then we lose. So in that type of environment, banks don't want to lend money for mortgages because, you know, it's kind of like catching a falling knife. No one really wants to do it. And so, you know, and then, you know, with rising interest rates, we see state and local governments have to, you know, it becomes more expensive for them to borrow money, do the things they need to do. The U.S. government has to pay more, you know, to do what they need to do. Junk bonds, you know, and corporate debt of all forms, you know, corporations have to pay more. You know, the value of junk bonds in a financial panic we saw back in 2008, the value of junk bonds drops dramatically and rates skyrocket. You know, there's so much that, you know, interest rates are so much the key to all this. And to a lot of people, interest rates are very, very boring. But interest rates are so key in our financial system. And right now, the only way our financial system works is with super, super, super low interest rates. And if that change, if that paradigm changes, and it's starting to change, so much else changes. And, of course, the most important thing is there are about $441 trillion of interest rates derivatives sitting out there. And if all of a sudden we see a shock to the system and interest rates start to rise dramatically, and they've already started to rise, but if they start going up, you know, at a steady clip, all of a sudden a whole lot of those interest rate derivatives contracts go bad, and we could potentially see, you know, losses, derivatives losses like we've never seen before. We could see too big to fail banks get into trouble very, very quickly. When you're talking about $441 trillion, you're talking about an amount of money that is almost inconceivable.
That's right. If interest rates are important, are they important as an absolute number, or are they important in relation to the current inflation rate?
Well,
is it important whether I pay 1% interest or 5% interest as an absolute number, or is it only important in relation to inflation rates? For example, if we had 8% inflation and I'm being paid 5% interest, I'm losing money if I'm a creditor lending. So are we concerned about interest rates as an absolute or in relation to inflation?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, for example, you know, on an absolute scale, you know, if the average rate on interest rate on U.S. government debt went back up to 6% where it was before, then all of a sudden U.S. government's paying out $1 trillion a year just in interest on the national debt. And so, you know, whether that's relative to inflation or not, that's a massive number and something we can't afford to do. But in terms of, but yes, the Federal Reserve does understand that it's also important as the interest rate relative to inflation. It's so psychological. And so the Federal Reserve and the federal government, in fact, since the late 1970s, they changed the way that inflation is calculated more than 20 times. And each time they want to make inflation look lower for a variety of reasons. For example, you know, if inflation really is 1 or 2% where it's been, you know, the official government numbers showing it's been the last few years, well, then people say, yeah, I'll lend money perhaps to the U.S. government at 3% or 2.5% or whatever because I'm ahead of the rate of inflation. But the real rate of inflation calculated by, you know, John Williams of shadowstats.com and other people out there, you know, people have said the real rate of inflation, if it was calculated how it used to be, should be about 8 or 10%. And you know, there's some minor differences there, but it's definitely much higher than the federal government is saying. And if that's the case, if the real rate of inflation is 8%, then why in the world would anyone want to lend U.S. government money at 1 or 2 or 3%? You're losing your shirt. And so, you know, it's my contention that the interest rates we're seeing today on U.S. Treasury simply are not rational.
Yeah.
And you and this kind of condition can last in financial markets for a while, but eventually things want to go back to rational levels. And when that occurs, it's going to be disastrous for our financial system.
You know, one of the things I've observed over time is that interest rates are of marginal utility right now. That's the position I have on this for this reason. When we had currency that was backed by gold and silver. The money was essentially locked within the United States. The government could set the interest rates, and creditors had two choices. They either said, I don't like this and I'm not going to lend any money at all, or I'm not going to let my money just sit, but I will lend it even at the minuscule interest rates that the government sometimes declares. But with fiat currency and digital currency, we can now cross the oceans. You couldn't take money from Topeka and lend it, even if they were paying higher interest rates, lend it in England or Europe or Asia, because the process of endanger and risk of moving physical money, gold and silver, from this country to foreign countries was more of a risk than many people wanted to embrace. But today, if they lower interest rates, all creditors have to do is move their money to other nations, and they can do it at the speed of light over the internet, and it actually hollows out the amount of money that's available. You may be able to borrow at 1% interest, you just can't find any money to any lenders who will lend at that rate, because they've taken their money and moved it to Asia or moved it to Europe or someplace that's paying higher interest rates. As a result, from my perspective, the interest rates become, as you suggested, they're there for psychological impact, but lowering interest rates, from my perspective, is likely to drive creditors out of this country. Now we have no money to lend. We could get it at cheap rates, but it's so cheap, nobody will lend it at that rate. Do you follow what I'm saying? And if so, does it make any sense to you, or do you think I'm mistaken?
No, I agree with you. We live in a global financial system which is more interconnected than ever before, and money can fly around at the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
And so where once upon a time money was somewhat limited in mobility and didn't move as rapidly, today things can shift and move at that lightning speed. And that means that financial crashes can also happen more rapidly than ever before. So we really live at what I believe is an unprecedented time. And what makes things so much worse is that Wall Street has been transformed into the biggest casino in the history of the world. And every single day, the largest banks in our country are literally walking a tightrope. And most of the time, they're able to walk that tightrope, and the rewards for walking that tightrope and winning are great, and they can make a massive amount of money. But as we saw back in 2008, when there's a misstep, when something goes wrong, and all of a sudden they fall off that tightrope, well, the consequences can be dramatic.
When we have Wall Street working as a casino, that's one description. Are they a casino by choice, or is this simply the result of an economy where no one really knows what's going on? And if so, is Wall Street most accurately described as a casino, or is it a criminal enterprise? And can we distinguish between the two if no one really understands what's happening? Do you have any kind of an answer for that?
Well, I think it could be described as both, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Las Vegas, the early days of Las Vegas, the mob, ran a lot of the casinos. You know, it's kind of the same way today. We've got these, institutions which are just really corrupt, and they're running this gigantic casino, and most of the time they're doing great, and they're making tons of money. But you just take Goldman Sachs. But Goldman Sachs has total assets of about $114 billion, and that sounds like a lot until you find out that they have total exposure to derivatives of more than $41 trillion. So in essence, their exposure to derivatives is more than 362 times greater than their total assets. So these financial institutions, they're just pyramids of risk and debt and leverage, but they're
and
the
confidence.
Core of our financial
and the illusion of confidence. We're going to take a break for a couple more commercial announcements. I'll be back with Michael Snyder, author of The Beginning of the End, in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
countries have denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a KU band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
I'm Alfred Addis here with Michael T. Snyder. Michael is the author of The Beginning of the End, a novel dealing with economic circumstances that we're likely to face in the future here in the United States, 442 pages, and you can get a free copy. If you would like to place an order, any order for gold with Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188, you buy a free copy of Michael's book. Melody will provide that with your order of one gold coin, 10 gold coins, whatever, but you'll get a free copy of Michael's book. If you're looking for gold, give Melody a call, 1-800-375-4188. In the first two segments of the program, one of the persistent themes in our conversation has been the confusion, lack of control, lack of even understanding by the people at the top in universities, of the people at the top, even in government. We are flying blind. We have people that are controlling the economy, and they don't seem to understand really what they're doing. And my question, Michael, is do you think they don't understand? If we're correct, and I agree with you, that there's a complete lack of understanding at the top, do you think they fail to understand because technology has become so complex? Do you think they fail to, because technology has become so advanced? Do you think they fail to understand because the world has become so complex? Is a global economy that much harder to understand than a national economy? That would be part. Or do you think they fail to understand simply because we have moved to a fiat currency where the value is in a constant state of flux? Can we understand economics if we don't have a fixed value for our currency?
I think the fact that we've gone to a fiat currency and then it's blown up over the past 30, 40 years to this ridiculous bubble that, we really are in unprecedented territory. And if you go to, go to college and you take Econ 101, which I did when I went to university, they don't present a variety of viewpoints. There's just one viewpoint. It's the print and borrow and spend philosophy, and they say, oh, this is how our system works. This is great. There's no problem with it. And so, And the American people are not presented alternatives. They're just presented one system, one, and they're told this is how things work, and this is great, and there's no problems with it. And so all the people who are running things, you know, if they have been trained in economics, they've been just presented this one philosophy, and they've been told that it works, and they've been told that there's no problem with it. And so they're kind of married to this system, which is inherently flawed, and I didn't understand it until I got out of, I got done with my education. Until I got out of law school, I didn't understand these things. So, go ahead.
When they say that there's only one system, essentially, they give you one system of thought and say, this is it, this is how it works. That has to inspire confidence. If there's only one system, then we can understand what's going on. We have confidence in the ideas that we are espousing. But when you begin to understand that there's two systems or 10 different systems of thought on what's going on, and there is great uncertainty, where do we find our confidence? And how can confidence be maintained in a system where the monetary system depends on public confidence? How is confidence maintained when you find out there's more than one answer to the question?
Well, I think we're going to see a shaking of confidence, and especially, you know, people were told that, okay, what happened in 2008? You know, our leaders fixed those problems. Everything's okay. It was just, you know, a kind of an anomaly. But now, it didn't mean that our system was fundamentally flawed. Everything's okay. It was just a one-time deal. Now we're moving forward, and, you know, everything's going to be great. Once this next wave hits, this next financial crash, and I believe it's going to get even worse than we saw back in 2008, I believe it's going to shatter confidence throughout this country, because people are going to realize, hold on, this is not a one-time thing. This is something that's happening again. None of the problems were fixed. And that realization is going to cause a massive rethinking in this country, a tremendous amount of debate, and, you know, a tremendous amount of loss of confidence and panic. And people are going to be demanding answers. They're demanding the system be fixed. And there's going to be a lot of anger toward Wall Street. And I think we're going to see economics and economic issues go to the top of the national priorities once this next wave of financial panic and the next stock market crash hits.
When we talk about economic issues, you know, economic issues can be expressed in terms of numbers. We've got interest rates and inflation rates and unemployment rates and so on, and we can calculate these numbers and use different formulas to reach what appears to be an understanding. But do you think our problems with economics is simply a matter of understanding the numbers, or is it based on something unstable in our moral foundation? Is economics just about numbers and how many units of widgets we're producing today, or does it have something to do with moral values? And if so, how's that impact our future?
Well, I totally believe that it has to do with our moral values, our moral standing, and that's the frightening thing, because that's not so easy to fix. Numbers are easier to fix,
yeah.
But in terms of the moral character of the American people, that's not so easy to fix. And today, you know, I believe that we're seeing, you know, this philosophy of buy now and pay later. Everyone wants it now. Everyone, you know, people say, oh yeah, the government should have a balanced budget, but they don't want to give up their government. They don't want to pay more taxes themselves to pay for this giant government we have. So everyone wants to have their cake and eat it too. You know, we've been living so far above our means for so long that we think that this is normal, but it's not normal. It's an illusion. At the same time, our debt is skyrocketing like never before. Our economic infrastructure is being absolutely gutted. We've lost 56,000 manufacturing facilities since the year 2001. We've seen millions of good-paying jobs shipped overseas. You know, so. But the moral character of the American people, where we're greedy, we're selfish, we want it now, we're willing to sacrifice the future and the futures of our children and our grandchildren and make things worse for them to make things better now, to borrow money now, to borrow, you know, for governments to run up debt now. So, yeah, I totally believe that there's definitely a moral component to all of this.
When are we going to see the troubles that you're describing? I will bet that 80 to 99% of the audience for this program agrees with everything you and I have been talking about from the first 40 minutes or 50 minutes of the program. But the big question is, when does the stuff hit the fan? We all know the destination, but what's the timing? Do you have a prediction?
Yeah, well, I kind of differ from some people in that my perspective is that the economic collapse is not a single event, but that it's an unfolding over time. 2008, that was a wave. Now, I believe another wave is rapidly approaching, and I believe that sometime between now and the end of 2015, the wave is going to strike. And there are thousands of moving pieces here. That's why it's hard to pinpoint exactly, because when you're dealing with literally thousands of variables, it's hard to pinpoint and say, okay, here's the date. But I believe that, you know, if I were to put a window on it between today and the end of 2015, I believe this next wave is going to strike, and it's going to be really, really bad. Financial panic, massive stock market crash, credit freezing up, unemployment skyrocketing through the roof, millions of families losing their homes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then that's not going to be the end of it. There's going to be a response. There's going to be tremendous inflation. There's going to be chaos and panic and political division and civil unrest in the streets. I believe when unemployment skyrocketed well into the double digits, we're going to see rioting, civil unrest, and a huge spike in crime in our cities. And I've tried to portray a lot of these things in my new novel, because people said, well, what is it going to look like? You know, I get that question a lot. So I tried, in my new novel, to paint a picture of what's coming over the next few years.
All right, and the novel is entitled The Beginning of the End, and why don't we spend the last 5 minutes of the program discussing your novel and give people an outline of what they... And, you know, I read the description. I haven't seen the book myself yet, but I did read the description. And I was wondering whether you were inspired by something like Atlas Shrugged.
I was, uh-huh. Because, you know, what I call this kind of writing, I call it fact-tion. It's kind of where fact and fiction kind of meet. In that Atlas Shrugged, it's, you know, a wonderful story, but it's communicating truth about the real world at the same time. And so that's what I endeavored to do. Or another example of this is George Orwell, 1984. It's a fictional story, but he was communicating something very powerful about the world. And our society today, it's an entertainment-addicted society. You know, people are constantly plugged into movies, television, or they love a good story. You know, we've seen some examples of that in the recent years, with whether it's Harry Potter or Twilight or The Hunger Games. You know, people love a good story. And what I wanted to do is to be able to have something that our entertainment-addicted society could relate to and would pick up and read, but then communicate truth to them at the same time, help people to wake up, understand what is coming. And I've incorporated so much of what I've learned over the past few years that I write about in my articles into the book, throughout, woven throughout the chapters. And so people hopefully are, you know, enjoy the story and are entertained, but at the same time they're being bombarded by all these nuggets of truth. And, you know, hopefully it's a tool that people will not only read and be entertained themselves, but that they can give it to family and friends, and that it can help them wake up to what's coming.
Are these nuggets of economic truth, or are these nuggets of moral truth, or both, or something else? What kind of nuggets are we talking about?
Well, there's a lot about economics in there, but I've also included other things. I included, for example, something I like to write about is the advancing of Big Brother technology and turned out to be really timely, because all the stuff with NSA spying is broken in the last couple months. But I included so much about that in the book in terms of the ability of the government to surveil us and watch us and track us. So, I've incorporated a lot of that into the book as well. So I've incorporated a lot of other things as well, too, into the book, not just economics. It's kind of more comprehensive than that, but I've definitely, the book has a strong focus on economic issues.
In your book, do you anticipate that the government is going to move into a more advanced police state? Or do you anticipate that we're going to see chaos where we are dominated more so by local gangs? Or what do you anticipate? What do you think is going to happen in general terms?
Well, I believe we're going to see definitely civil unrest in the cities. You know, people are going to be angry. They can't take care of their families. There's going to be rioting. There's going to be crime. There's going to be, you know, all those things that we started to see, you know, with the flash mobs or the Occupy movement, or, you know, these expressions of frustration and anger and lashing out. I believe we've just seen the tip of the iceberg. I believe that's going to become a lot worse. And then in response to that, I believe there's going to be a crackdown. I believe that eventually down the road, we will see martial law declared, at least on a temporary basis, in some major U.S. cities to deal with some of the unrest and so forth. So I believe that the growth of the police state will be, in to a certain extent, a response to kind of the meltdown of society. And I kind of describe it as the thin veneer of civilization that we all take for granted. You know, we all need to be able to, you know, when we leave our homes and go out to interact with the overall society and to go shopping or whatever we're doing, we need to be able to trust one another that, you know, okay, no one's going to attack me. I can trust this person I'm dealing with across the counter or that I meet on the street. And this thin veneer of civilization, I believe, is already starting to break down, and that will accelerate, I believe, in the years ahead.
What sort of recommendations might people expect? I'm going to assume that your book essentially presents a recommended, you know, how do we avoid this, minimize the problem, minimize our exposure to the problem that's coming. If we're going to get to the end, how do we mitigate? And we've got about 45 seconds left.
Okay. Anything we can do to become more independent of the system is great, whether it's starting your own business, storing up gold and silver. I love gold and silver, particularly silver. You know, storing up food and supplies, learning how to grow your own garden, alternative energy. All those things are great ways to become more independent of the system because the system is failing.
All right. Michael, again, why don't you give folks a little information on the economiccollapseblog.com, give you about 15 seconds, and then we have to close or done.
Sure. You can find my website, theeconomiccollapseblog.com. If you go to Google and you type in The Economic Collapse, it'll be the first result that comes up. I hope people will stop by and visit.
All right. Michael, thanks very much for being on the program today. I look forward to seeing a copy of your book. I'm sure Melody will get one for me. And we look forward to having you back. Thank you. And folks, thank you for listening. I hope you'll tune in tomorrow when I'll be back with Melody Cederstrom. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Michael Snyder, and Frank the producer.
Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. There never seems to be a single penny left for me.